then you'll have learned something really cool, maybe. We hope. And in fact, that's what really you're doing here is you're just sort of twisting these vectors. That's all we're doing. It's a pretty subtle signal. Now here it's nice and big, but I have the version of another version of that on your show. So this is the story in CMOS. MEO-control, of course, were used to these really tiny signals we measured 10 years ago. The new signals are really, really small, nanotron level, so it requires enormous sensitivity to do this. And, you know, we were pretty excited about these incredibly sensitive detectors we had on Boomerang 10 years ago. They're not going to cut it. Well, one of them won't cut it. You need lots of them. But there are problems, right? It's not just enormous sensitivity. Over the years, we've talked about various ways we could get the sensitivity to do this. But it's not just sensitivity that's the issue, because we're trying to make this measurement in the presence of an enormous, enormous foreground, namely the temperature fluctuations in the CMB. And so now, whenever you're making a polarization measurement, you're making a difference of a, you know, you're looking at the sky with this polarization and looking at it with this polarization, and you're trying and you're taking a difference. And you're looking for a tiny difference. And so if you're like pointed off just a little bit on one of them, you're measuring the gradient, you got a huge foreground. Or if they're not quite lined right, or okay, so this is a problem. It's hard. And then we actually have a pretty big foreground to our B-mode signals in the form of the E-mode signals. It's pretty polarized. Now, remember we said sort of going from E to B, all you have to do is rotate your gondola or your telescope just a little bit, and all of a sudden you've got a B-mode signal you didn't mean. So you can imagine this is going to be a problem. So we sort of look at, well, how big is this E-mode foreground versus L? And it's got a kind of a minimum in here, sort of where the ratio of these two kind of minimizes down in tens of L. You get above 100, and then it's getting pretty hard, because you really have to, the E-mode signals are so much larger than the B-modes. So it might suggest that this might not be a bad place to measure, as Andy's already alluded, trying to go after this bump here. Right, we'll get the lensing, right? So the other way you can get helicity in this polarizing vector field is by gravitational lensing. And it's got this fairly well-known spectrum, we think. Well, yeah, so this would be a great place to do it for lensing, because there's no lensing here. Basically no contamination at all from the lensing signal. Not too bad in here. This is assuming that R equals 0.1, so there's a number throughout there. Nobody says R is 0.1, but we'll use R as 0.1 as our straw man target. At R of 0.1, the lensing isn't much of a problem in here in the sort of tens of L. So it's getting worse as you get closer to L of 100. So once again, as you can see here, it's not such a terrible place to try and measure B modes, unless R is quite low, in which case you'll measure lensing B modes, and that'll be something. The shape?
No, for instance,
my understanding is it's pretty well known at the tens of percent number. It might be better than that, you know? Yeah.
Is that better?
Better than 10%.
It's
10%. It's really well known.
10%.
Maybe less. 10%? What do you think? Anybody
it's driven by stuff, you know, new notes with stuff in the foreground.
Yeah,
so it's like, you know, it's the source which we know is present.
Yeah,
it's not
my understanding is it's not a terribly exciting science chart, if that's what you're asking.
No, but if, for instance, you would measure a single term equal 50, right?
Yeah.
You would find an amplitude. Now, how you would be determining what is the contribution from lensing and what is the contribution from...
If this number is like 0.8, I would say you don't. If this number is 0.1, then
you can forget about lensing.
Yeah.
Right, but here, so to phrase it another way, imagine you only measure from L of 20 to L of 60, and you've got a signal corresponding to R of 0.05. Convince me that's not lensing.
Exactly.
Part.
And that's the
subtle part. So I would say,
if you're
saying, great, first detection of big something, let's work to another
period. So that's the point we're going to make later on, but it's not a great time to make it. Hang in here. Your limit on R from lensing B will probably be on the order of 0.03. ish. Now there's other ways people talk about as you try to pull this out. We're not talking about that in this generation. Okay, so here's the Smith chart. We're going to observe some Langer scales kind of poking in this region. We have 2,000 kilometers. So the old school boomerang.
1 kilometer for the first paper. Now we're talking about more. And we've heard discussions from Andrew and Mark on how this has come to be. And then, and then a post office rotating halfway plate to control systematics to make sure that those differences really are right. So Andrew showed this picture, but I still think it's cool. Here we are flipping back and forth, or with and without B modes. Carlo Cantaldi made this one. And larger in scale. And it's been filtered down to be a little bit clearer. And so what you're seeing really is sort of these vectors rotating. So that's sort of what we're trying to not do, is we want to measure these directions and these amplitudes really, really precisely. Well, yeah.
There.
So there's foregrounds. And the foreground
story is a fun story.
Because it depends, as has been pointed out several times, the sky is incredibly non-Gaussian. So you can't, talking about the power spectrum of the foregrounds, well, you can talk about it, but it really depends on where you're looking. But at large angles, at low frequencies, here we have frequency across your color, right? So this is down toward microwave, and this is getting up towards sub-millimeter waveband. The low frequencies were dominated by synchrotron. So WMAP, especially in the lowest bins, has incredibly high res, high signal to noise, high fidelity maps of the synchrotron. And we think we know pretty well the behavior of synchrotron radiation. I mean, there may be some funniness as you go to higher frequencies, but that's pretty well understood, and it's big. At lower frequencies, or higher frequencies, shorter wavelengths, we're dominated by this dust polarization. And so you want to take this whole thing out. So maybe a good idea is to just stay away from synchrotrons. You want to move up here to the moderately high frequencies where synchrotrons getting down to irrelevant levels. So SPIDER is going to have the four purple frequency bins with the goal mainly of subtracting out the dust or determining if there's dust problems there if we go deep enough. And relying on WMAP 8-year data to guard against synchrotron. And so Sunil Gobala at Caltech did a bunch of simulations on this just trying to determine how well can we actually pull out the CMB in the presence of sort of expectable foregrounds. I'm sort of on a large section of the sky that includes both good places and bad places. We can do fine. We were looking at numbers at R0.1, maybe a 40% overall degradation in our noise with these sorts of sensitivity. And if we choose a part in the sky, which we'll be able to do in one of our flights, with lower foregrounds, we can do even much better. So we think with this strategy, even if the foregrounds are as bad as we think they might be, we're going to be able to remove them at a pretty good level. We could be wrong, but it seems like we're fairly confident that this is a good strategy and fairly conservative. So we've got four close space frequency bands. Oh, just for reference, SPIDER is going to be measuring about 8% of the sky in the Antarctic flight, which I'll get to in a minute. And we have 2,000 detectors. We're really burning a hole in the sky. So our perfect built error bars are going to be much deeper than Planck. Now, Planck is all sky. And they're going to be looking at the very largest angular scales and, of course, looking at a bunch of other stuff. But if your whole goal was to measure stuff in this little spot in the sky, the SPIDER is not a bad approach because you're sort of burning a hole in the sky. Just give you a comparison in sensitivity there. Not more. Okay, I guess the right way to say it is the sensitive, the error bar per pixel for Spider in the 8% of the sky we're going to look at will be substantially better than Planck. But Planck gets the entire sky. Good stuff, bad stuff, mediocre stuff, the best, the worst, all of it. And so it depends on what your goal is. And
for this particular goal, L of
20 or L of 10, L of 20 to L of 80 B modes, I think Spider is a great approach.
I just want to say, since I wear a long time, it's a very, very, very difficult thing.
Yeah, and that's the other point.
We do not know what will limit Planck's ability to measure polarization. Thus, not knowing that, we can't tell you how well it will do. It wasn't designed to do it. We also don't know how well Spider will do. It's not built yet, and it's a balloon. They're significantly orthogonal approaches to making the measurement. It's good to do both of them. You cannot say that one is better than the other.
I don't have any conflicts. If I put in a plug for Planck, that must be good, right? There are plenty of experiments out there with, or several anyway, more sensitivity per pixel than WMAP. Over little patches of the sky. Not a replacement. Planck will do a thing no one else is even trying.
So among other things, Planck will measure polarization with higher angular resolution over the entire sky, over a broader sphere of frequency.
So for instance, if you want to start trying to play these games where you're moving the lensing, you're going to have a resolution to start thinking.
My own best bet is that if you were, for example, to take the plus Spider data sets with different systematics and different attributes together.
What is the sensitivity in microcalcic arc minute over that 8% of the sky?
I have to look up the numbers again. I don't have to sit on top of my head. It's microcalcic arc minute.
It'll be a little deeper than Planck.
Well, it's actually about factor 4. The on-paper sensitivities. The on-paper sensitivity per pixel for Spider, for the Langer scales, which it can do, which are not near as much as Planck, is about 4 times deeper. For the part of the sky it can do, which is much less than Planck.
But I don't think it's about sensitivity.
And you do get
the temperature mass, you know.
In principle, yeah. But I would be surprised if there's anything to pull out of the temperature mass.
There's a calibration.
Obviously, we're going to be calibrating off of WMAP. And that's going to be absolutely crucial. But, yeah. Anyway, stop right there. There it is.
We've got 6 telescopes. Each one of these telescopes is basically a bicep tube. The differences are irrelevant to anybody here. And I would have even have a hard time enumerating them. All in one giant cryostat, which is designed to have weeks of hold time, so we can have a really long balloon flight. Each of the telescopes, as Andrew mentioned, it was single frequency. The idea is then we can optimize everything about that telescope for that frequency, minimize all the internal reflections, and have the best possible wave plate. Each one optimized to minimize systematics for that particular frequency, which is something you can't do when you're trying to make a compromise.
These are actually not horns, those are apples. Each telescope will be diffraction limited at its frequency. So the high frequency ones will, in fact, have higher resolution, just because it's cheaper to engineer one size. And then, all right, so the high frequency ones have high resolution, that's too bad. You would make them smaller to save money, but you wouldn't save money, so you make the same size. We had a discussion about we should shrink them, we might, to save weight. But. Okay, so 2 scan modes, you spend the whole thing in a circle, and not half the sky.
You only can do that at night, limits where you can fly from. The second mode is you do 90-degree scans in the sky, So the telescope will be able to do both. Stratospheric balloons is what we're going to fly on. And we're going to fly on probably a 1 million cubic meter. So that's cube root of 2 smaller in dimension than this. So about that size. 1,800 kilogram payloads, flights up to 42 days are possible with these things. Launch from places like McMurdo, Antarctica, Alice Springs, or Kernes, Sweden. We're planning to do launches from these two places. And during the flight, you get near continuous telemetry, but it's a very skinny pipe. Why in a balloon? Well, it's about the atmosphere.
Where? In each place?
Well, Scott and I were doing one flight from Alice Springs in Australia, and one flight from Antarctica.
So it would be two balloons or the same balloon?
Two different flights.
Sequentially.
The first flight would be from Alice Springs, and the second flight would be from Antarctica. And that's the October balloon. Yeah.
That's the discussion right now. So, about the atmosphere. So here we have color, frequency, and the amount of loading you're getting from the atmosphere. And loading kind of goes with noise. More loading, more noise. Blue line here is the noise you get from South Pole, which is pretty good. Or the loading from South Pole, so it's a pretty good sight. The mustard is the loading you get from the lowest we'd ever consider flying a balloon, sort of 89,000 feet. And you see that the loading we get is much, much lower. And that allows Spider to be, at least in the bottom bins, to be the noise more or less dominated by loading from the cosmic microwave background itself. It's getting close to as sensitive a telescope as you could ever make by getting it out of the atmosphere. And it allows us to go to these higher frequencies, which at South Pole end up being entertained by a lot of absorption lines. Down these two bins, the bands in these two windows here at South Pole are actually quite good. And so Bicep 2 and Bicep 1 and Spud are operating down here. To get these higher frequencies, if you really think you need to understand the foregrounds, that requires getting out of the atmosphere. So what are the flights like? Well, you launch from a place called McMurdo Station in Antarctica, which is sort of academics paradise because you get to live in a dorm and eat in a cafeteria and no money for 1,000 miles. So here's a picture of this boomerang launch in 2003. This trajectory here was the boomerang 98 flight. This was a 10-day flight. Typically, to go around once takes 10 to 15 days. Now, it's become standard for there to be multiple flights. So typical flights now are on the order of 30 days, with a record of being 42 days. So this is a pretty neat opportunity from Antarctica. Mark and I are just back from a flight this winter on this telescope here called BLAST, which was a sub-millimeter telescope designed to look at star formation and dust and starburst galaxies at high redshifts. And, you know, we'll be announcing all sorts of exciting results from that in the eventual future.
Well, there's a few reasons. One is they won't launch you in the winter. There's a
it's too cold.
It can be done.
Yeah, the weather's too bad.
Yeah. These nice flight trajectories happen in the summer. In the wintertime, the winds are squirrely, you don't know where they're going to go. And they've done some things down there that you don't necessarily stay where you can carry the payload. The other thing is a really annoying technical thing, and that is you need to power your telescope. And we could come up with a solution, maybe, but 40 days of no sun to power your solar arrays.
Yeah,
we haven't really got a solution to that problem. So, in fact, Antarctic flights, you don't have the daytime to power your system.
But here, when you wrote the dates, okay, so that you get the sample, so it's to January, but when you are supposed to have your supply for you?
We'll get there.
So on the detectors, Andrew's already mentioned it, but what's really cool, Shaolin at Caltech sent me this data here, is they've got data on these detectors. They've got beams coming off these phased arrays and noise that looks pretty plausible and band passes. And so it's the progress on building this receiver is pretty exciting. And it's a real thing. Naturally, we're flying it soon. So it better be real, and it is. The optics, once again, Andrew mentioned this. We want to have an incredibly stable telescope. And you don't want the focus changing. You don't want the pointing changing. You want anything twisting or moving. And, you know, okay, with BLAST, that's a 2-meter telescope. It can't be in the cryostat. And all during the flight, we had a little actuator there that kept adjusting the focus. And it stayed pretty constant. If we're trying to do beam modes with BLAST, I'd be a little worried. But here, we can put the whole telescope in a cryostat. And the whole thing is sitting at 4 Kelvin and doesn't change. And so once you've characterized it, it's there. And it's fantastic. Beautifully stable instrument that you can actually characterize and actually get the results out of. Systematics, big thing. We've done, Carrie McTavish at CETA has done a whole bunch of simulations. This is one of the plots she gave me. Trying to understand to what level are we going to be affected by systematic effects. Things like how good do we rotate, how well do we know the orientation of our wave flight, how well do we know our calibration, how well do we know our pointing, all these sorts of things that can screw up the measurement. And she's been running simulations now where she puts into the time stream one after another, after another, after another of these different systematics and understanding what specs we have to meet. And it looks, at this point, we're very confident that we can meet all the specs required to not be systematics limited down to R of 0.01. And that's our goal. And we're going to meet that, which is pretty cool. It wasn't totally obvious to me that we could when we started these simulations, but it's looking promising. So how are we going to do? Two flights. The first flight, we're going to do a flight from Australia. Every year, the winds in the stratosphere turn around. And there's a few-week period there where the winds are very, very low, launch from the center of Australia. And you can leave it up for several days before it blows off the ocean. The nice thing about Australia is that Australia has nights, which means we can do the super spin mode. And so we're going to, every night for 2, 3, 4, 5 nights, we're going to sit and map 50% of the sky. And allow us to get all the way down to low Ls. We're going to get all the way down to this bump down here. Now, this is the E mode spectrum. We're not going to get deep enough in those 2 or 3 nights to measure B modes. But we're going to be able to measure the EE and the TE down here at the very low Ls. Now, why is that? This is planned for 2009. Why is that interesting? Well, if you can measure this bump, you can do a really good job at measuring tau. And you measure tau, you can start breaking some of the degeneracies in the NS tau measurements. You do a better job at NS, understand things about epoch of reionization. And just for a comparison, the mustard here is the 8-year WMAP forecast. And this is a forecast of what we think we can get with the first spider flight, getting tau down now to pretty high precision. And so there's a Livia Doria in this platform. So this is pretty cool. That's our test flight.
I like that. So this is planned now for 2009. So it's not long, 2 years, we should be actually in the field tightening bolts, launching shortly after.
So it's December 2009 or?
Two years from right now.
Yes, from
right now. Would be when we should be in the field putting it together. And then to analyze it. That typically takes 12, 18 months. We'll see. We always want to be faster than that, but then the engine ends up being fast. And then the power later, recovery willing, we'll be heading down to Antarctica for a 30-day flight going back 8 sides of the sky. And this is going to be fantastic. This is a forecast that Hubble and Hubble made for us. How well we're going to do on the B-bones. This is an R.1, just at something. And these are the air bars in each of these bins. And just to reference, the green line here is sort of our 1 sigma noise level. Just as another way of looking at it. This says that up to sort of L of 60 or something, we're going to be sound variance limited, not noise limited. And then this can drop down. And so our detection threshold is going to be on the order of 0.03. At the several sigma level, it's a fuzzy number, so take that as fuzzy. 0.2 might be 0.3, and some might be 0.5, if I say that. But clearly, at that level, we're going to start hitting the lensing beam. So there's five wells we can do with this approach, and we're going to get there within probably a few years.
And at each level of sigma, there will be detection in this case when you know.
Well, at point 1, this is like, I don't know, 50 sigma.
So it's sure.
At point 1, you're not wondering. At 0.03, you're there's another issue of circumference. So at point 1, we, knowledge wise, we've got now what the system is really going to be, our forecasting. We're good. But then something actually happens and we say, well. So the known unknowns are, I don't know. I felt like I couldn't possibly live up to this great stature, so I'll try.
And also, we can be sure in this range that it's primordial radiation, not just some kind of lensing or something.
Okay,
like
so
that.
At point 1, yes. At point 3,
no, point of three, okay, it's 3.
Point 3 times the line set.
Yeah. Well, no, well, actually, at this point, it's around, what, about 5 times, 6, yeah. 6, 8 times lensing at point 1. At, if it's twice lensing, I get nervous. I don't know. That if, these are fuzzy numbers, but I think that's give you an idea. Point 1, yeah, we can do that. Point 3, we'll have the sensitivity to it. If we're going to get nailed, we'll see.
So, but what is the problem? But is the way to detect the polarization of even larger telescopes? Because amplitudes there, because of spherianization,
yep,
is much higher, yeah?
Yes. So, what we need to do to get those is to get, we need to get 30 days of dark to get to the same depth. But there would be less depth to get more sky. But our estimates is that at 20 days of dark, you're marginal. I'm sorry, 10 days in the dark, the 250 hours, we're kind of marginal. I think 800 hours of dark could do the job. But we don't currently have a way of doing that. I guess that's it.
So there are no experiments planned for BB measuring at very low multiples?
Down here?
Yeah.
At the moment, there's nothing on the table.
You said nobody right now. For instance, if it's 10%, it's equal 0.5. Can you say that Planck will be able to measure BB component in this region?
You cannot say that Planck could not measure.
Planck can do 0.1 in terms of sensitivity.
Yeah, the question is,
how
is this mass going to be? And as it can be controlled, the problem is it's very difficult mission to simulate. And this is analysis systematics is not
And what is the expectation for the data analysis? Because you put the data for the flights. Now, after you get this data, how long did it take? It's optimistic or pessimistic? Because we had this experience with boomerangs and W map, because
I would say the answer is you don't know.
Right.
You don't know.
Depends on what
it's never been done before. You don't know.
The W map is that the data were made public to everybody maybe four months after we promised that they
This I understand, but you see actually because W map 3 years, release. It was delayed. You know that it's because no one knew what is going on. Also, with boomerang, I canceled just to
come back. You're going to put out a theory.
It's naive, but how well can you be sure that there's no kind of Faraday location?
Yeah, at the about 10 gigahertz type of place, which you'd expect for irradiation. And so I would think that the very long, you know, but we're not there. We're up in industrial frequencies. And my, when I ask people about this, they say fire irritation isn't an issue in millimeters.
How much is there of the large scale?
You mean fire irritation through the Milky Way? Fire irritation goes as a strong function in wavelength, like lambda right. squared or something, and it's it's gone even for LFI.
So at 2 gigahertz it's measured, and it's understood what the frequency difference is, and it, projected out, but my understanding of talking to people who know, which wouldn't be me, is that it's like a thing I know because they told me.
The cool thing is, if you're interested, you can use Planck to figure out what Faraday rotation is in your low frequency data, because there's none in Planck data.
It's obviously one of the things that we have learned. And I think we'll have a for sure time to ask somebody to say, oh, not yet.
You would see it in the data in any case.
What?
In the same thing, that if you had cosmic strength, you could also have a B mode at the same.
Oh, wonderful.
With a slightly different spectrum.
Okay. So it will be interesting at some point just to decide whether or not those can be distinguished. That would be even cooler.
So, if there are no further questions, let's thank us.